Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. Over the weekend, legislative forums around the state drew unprecedented crowds. Here in Central Iowa, a town hall in Ankeny drew 400 to 500 people and some very emotional, pointed questions directed at Republican legislators. Here in Story County, the tiny town of Gilbert drew 90 concerned citizens, but no Republican legislators, only the Democratic stalwarts from Ames, Senator Herman Kurmbach and Representatives Lisa Hedden and Beth Wassell-Crichel. This despite the fact that Gilbert is represented by Rob Bacon and Senator Jerry Bain, both Republicans. Bill Dix, the Senate Majority Leader representing Nevada and Story City, has been invited to three such forums and simply refuses to attend. Furthermore, he's scheduled no town hall meetings in any part of his district. What's up with that, people? Folks in the area will have a chance to speak to a Republican next weekend, however. Senator Jerry Bain will hold a forum at the Boone Public Library, known as Erickson Library, at 8 a.m. So get out your calendar and set your alarms, folks. That Saturday morning at 8 a.m., Senator Jerry Bain. Hopefully not all of the laws that are drawing controversy this year will be signed into law by then. On Sunday, a rally for Iowa's teachers and schools drew a reported 8,000 people to the Capitol. I was there and saw the crowd myself. This legislative session, teachers are being hit not only by what they feel is a dismally low 1.1 allowable growth cap in funding, but matching labor legislation, House Study Bill 84 and Senate File 213, are being called by the blog Labor Notes, quote, the most extreme, outrageous attack on collective bargaining rights they have yet seen, worse than the attacks on public employees in Wisconsin under Scott Walker, where several years later, schools are now lagging behind. Legislators are due to vote on that bill later today, Monday, and its opponents are expected to be filling the gallery. Well, today's show explores the question, does the Ames Community School District have a race problem? We will be joined by a guest who has opinions on this issue, and we'll hear audio from the middle school principal, Pam Stangland, and the most recent school board meeting. But first, it's Monday, so we've got this week's weather in a nutshell.
Community Radio, KHOI, and we're talking weather with ISU Extension climatologist Dr. Elwin Taylor. And Elwin, it felt like spring here this past weekend, didn't it?
Oh, boy, it has been lovely weather, and people in our part of the world saying, should we have spring this early in the year? What will it mean by the time it gets to real spring? Well, of course, with temperatures in the 40s each day as we go, well, at least to the middle of the week, and then in the 50s as we end the week up, it's beginning to look a lot like spring has already come. Well, we anticipate in the 6 to 10 day outlook from the National Weather Service that we will be experiencing warmer than usual temperatures east of the Continental Divide. Now, whenever the division for the nation is on the Continental Divide, it tends to persist longer than transient things that we sometimes see in the forecast that last a day or two, and then it changes to something else. So we could be an extended period of time on the warm side of usual. Well, we shall see. In the meantime, it is expected to be there for the better part of the next 2 weeks, warmer than usual, and also on the moist side of usual. Will it be wet for spring? Well, we don't know that yet, but on the moist side of usual gives us an indication that that may be so. During the past weekend, of course, we had a high pressure that was forming down over Kansas, and that was giving us air that was blowing clockwise around that area, bringing us air from Colorado rather than directly from the Gulf of Mexico. And so while as moist as it often is when we have a windy day that isn't out of the north, but nevertheless, we do expect the moisture to be on its way here. We do anticipate that we will have a month that is pleasant. The monthly forecast, as it came out, was for us to have a lot of moisture along the Canadian-U.S. border. But that was when they were thinking we might be moving toward La Nina. That may be changing now in an El Nino insight. We'll keep you posted on that when we get back with you next time.
Okay, thank you very much. ISU Extension climatologist Dr. Ellen Taylor joining us here. I'm Vaughn Kettleson on Community Radio KHOI.
And welcome back to Local Talk. Our guest, Monique Binkin, is assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at Iowa State University and is part of their Criminal Justice Studies program. We are glad to have Dr. Binkin with us today as someone who studies issues related to racial disparities in schools and other institutions. Monique has two children in Ames schools, and she is running for a seat on the Ames Community School District Board in the election this coming September. Welcome, Monique.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So we're going to set some context here, listen to some audio, and talk with Monique throughout the hour. In January, Iowa school report cards were released by the Department of Education for each public school in the state. This is the second year that the report cards have been made available. Schools are assigned one of six overall ratings, from exceptional down to priority. The ratings are based on each school's performance over a two-year period on up to eight educational measures, including the Iowa assessments, which are statewide standardized tests given to students in grades 3 through 11. Overall, Ames schools were rated as performing at high levels, with several schools moving up one or two levels. However, there were some troubling data in the school report cards. For the first time, the report card measured what are commonly called achievement gaps between students of different races and ethnicities, as well as what schools are doing to narrow those gaps. This measure is done by taking the combined math and reading proficiency score of white middle school students and comparing it to the combined proficiency score of students of other races and ethnicities. The results for Ames Middle Schools were as follows. White students showed 89.6% proficiency in math and reading. Asian students, very close, exceeding white students, 89.7%. Multi-race students, 88.5%. Hispanic students, 79.2%. And black students, 53.4%. That is a 36 percentage point drop below their white classmates. And that 53% for black students is actually a decrease from previous years. In addition, Ames Middle School scored 41 out of 100 points in measurements that assessed how they were closing this racial and ethnic achievement gap. As a result, the middle school fell two levels, from the highest rating of exceptional down to, quote, commendable. And this made headlines in the Ames Tribune. Following up on this finding from the school report card, I visited with Pam Stangland, the principal of the middle school, for an interview in which she spoke about how she perceived this data and how the school was addressing it. How did you feel when you saw that headline?
Well, of course, that wasn't the first I knew about the report card. And what is, I'll backtrack just a little bit to go back to the first year the report card was issued, which was 2015. And in 2015, Ames Middle School was the only school in the district to receive the exceptional ranking. It was also one of only 3% across the state. So at that point in time, there was no press about that, no communication at all. Now that we've gone down two rankings, now that has become hard news. We have went down in our minority achievement gap and also with our SES achievement gap, which are factors that we have been looking at longitudinally for over 4 years now. So this is not news to us. It wasn't shocking to us. It was like, yep, this is what it is. And being the principal, I was not pleased with the headlines, of course, but another side of me felt like it was a great opportunity to actually showcase what we are doing and that we know this is an issue.
Can you tell us some of the things that you've been doing, knowing over 4 years or more that these achievement gaps exist?
Definitely. We have a fantastic staff, and we have a very, very talented student body. But as we all know, our student population in Ames has changed in the last 15 to 20 years. And one of the things that we needed to do as a staff was move beyond the I've taught them phase to the they've learned it phase. I taught it, and I might have taught it brilliantly, but these four kids didn't learn it. So what do we need to do differently? So that's been our focus for the last 4 to 5 years. So we've instituted our tutorial period actually is a tier one or two intervention for just that situation that I described. Four of my kids didn't get the learning that was intended. So at that point in time, we gather those kids and we work with them in small groups during a specific time during the school day, but they get that immediate intervention time.
So that is something that you're implementing across the school body. How does that relate to racial disparity or social economic status disparity? How does that those two factors play in?
Okay, that's a great question, and that's what we've been looking at too. One of the downfalls with the IRA report card, according to my opinion, is that it only takes into account the Iowa assessments. It doesn't take into account any of the other factors that we look at. So one of the things that we've been noticing as we've been going through all of that data, we've been noticing it at team level with teams of teachers, we've been noticing it at an administrative level when we look over the whole student population, is that some of our minority populations are overrepresented in some groups and underrepresented in other groups. Here's the caution with that. That's not only true for our Black population or students of color, but it's also true for our students who are living in lower SES conditions. So those are the two things that we took a stab at this year, and we decided would be our professional development focus. In the fall, we hosted a poverty simulation so that our teachers could understand some of the struggles and troubles that our students in poverty face every day. Our focus for this January 16th day was to be a racial discussion and examine our racial data and to really brainstorm different ways that we could help with that. We had 7 professors lined up that were going to be helping from Iowa State to walk us through this process.
So that professional development date, of course, was canceled due to icy weather. Is there going to be a makeup for that?
Well, we're working on that, and we're hoping that we can get that in.
What do you tell a teacher if they come to you and say that they're having difficulty reaching, say, the African-American students in their classroom? What kind of advice do you give them?
There's tons of resources, and one of the things that we're very fortunate to have in this community is have resources both in the building and outside of the building. Right now we have 4 counselors who are in the building who are expert in developing rapport with students, relationships with students. I'll give you an example. When it comes to attendance, one of the assumptions that teachers and myself were making about a student one time with attendance was, this student doesn't care enough to come to school. They're arriving late 2 or 3 days a week. What's going on with the student? Well, when we sat down with a counselor and we sat down with the student and said, tell us more about this. Talk to us. We found that this student was responsible for putting his preschool sibling on the bus on certain mornings of the week as his parents were going to work early. That changed our whole perspective. But we wouldn't have had that knowledge unless we had good relationships with that student, the teachers had good relationships, the counselors had good relationships, and we could talk through those things.
Are there any adjustments to curriculum that would help make minority populations feel more included?
That's a great question, and that's something that we have not spent a lot of time with. We're trying to do things that are inclusive to all of our students, so we haven't looked at, I'm sure you're familiar with Iowa assessments and Iowa tests of basic skills, and we've had different cultures and different communities look at that test and say, oh, that's not the terminology that I would use. So those are things that definitely could help us. To be honest, we haven't reached that point in our process yet.
So you were focusing on the test. I'm kind of asking about the culture of the building. How have you developed the culture of the building to make students from all backgrounds feel welcome?
Well, I think that's a testament to the teachers. I really believe that we have moved from that, I taught them, they just didn't learn it, to I taught them, they didn't learn it, now what? How can I help? And you know what? That's a reflection on myself. When I came to this building 5 years ago, our average per year of number of student F grades, failing grades, was around 400. Now it is less than half of that. So as a building, we are working toward that. If we would have started with, let's just take a look at a subgroup and how can we help this subgroup, I think we would have been chasing our tail a bit.
It seems like you could get either in a positive spiral where students feel more and more trust in the school and its culture, or you can get into a negative spiral where they feel less and less. Where do you think you are with that?
Well, actually, we try to take data on that as well. So we distribute surveys to our kids, actually 3 times a year, about how they feel about Ames Middle School. Do they feel connected? Do they feel safe? Do they feel that they have a trusted adult that they can talk to? We did it last in the fall, and the results were very positive, that about 95% of our students felt that this was a safe place for them, a good place for them, and they could go to someone if they had a problem.
Was that data analyzed along racial lines?
No, it wasn't. That's a good point. That wasn't at that point in time because we were trying to do like a barometer of our building. My vision is to create a great environment and a learning environment for all students. And I'm very, this sounds weird perhaps, but I'm very excited about this because this is work that we've already started that we're aware of. And sometimes just drawing a little bit of attention to it gives it more credence, more credibility. But it's been difficult for me to create that sense of urgency. Wow, guys, we need to take a look at this data when we have, you know, our test scores that are consistently high. One of the things we've been talking about is building that cultural competency. Do we need to get experts in here to talk about what are some assumptions that we make and how can we work with that better? It's difficult for me as a white older female to relate to all of the different racial backgrounds and some of their experiences that they've had. So we need to get additional resources into our schools.
And that was Pam Stanglin, the principal of Ames Middle School, speaking with me about the recently released Iowa School Report Cards, which assessed, among other things, how students of different races are achieving, as well as what schools are doing to narrow the achievement gap. Ames Middle School received only 41 out of 100 points in closing the achievement gap. We have a guest in the studio here at Local Talk, Dr. Monique Vinken. She's a professor of sociology, but more importantly, she is running for the school board of Ames Community School District. So, Monique, you just heard the principal speak to this achievement gap a widening achievement gap, what we should note, between African Americans and white students at Ames Middle School. What were your thoughts when you heard this?
Well, there were several thoughts, of course, because it's a pretty complex problem, and she gave a pretty complex answer, I think. What I would say is I agreed with most of what she said, in fact. What we see in the Iowa report card is not unique to the Ames Middle School. It's also not unique to the Ames Community School District. These learning gaps are problems that are nationwide, and so seeing them here in Ames isn't a surprise. So I agree with her that these are not surprising numbers. She indicates that they've known about them for years, and so I agreed with her. The part where I think I was concerned as a parent was, and what's reflected in the IRA report card, is the response to the gap that we all know exists. And in hearing the response, I'm seeing why the score is 41 out of 100. What I'm seeing as someone who studies jurisdiction-specific interventions is I'm not seeing a concerted, integrated, evidence-based intervention. I'm seeing someone who realizes that there's a problem and is trying their best to solve a really complex problem without expertise and without consulting the literature. And when you do those things, you would affect change simply by accident.
Okay. All right. So that's the best we can do is an accidental improvement, no evidence-based measures taken.
Well, these are, as I said before, these are complex problems. And complex problems require complex solutions, especially when you're dealing with children who don't have one issue. The problem that we're seeing isn't that these children are black. That's not the problem. The problem is that these particular children are dealing with a variety of social issues that are impacting their experience in the learning environment, and the learning environment is impacting these children. And without an understanding of the ways in which there are reciprocal effects amongst the children and the learning environment, there can't be any positive change.
What sorts of steps might be taken? You probably have ideas on this as you want to become a school board member. So what types of interventions that you know of?
Well, there are a variety. And what I would say is that because there are so many, the Ames Community School District is in the perfect opportunity to select the one that will work the best for this particular jurisdiction. So in my capacity as an assistant professor at Iowa State University, I have several areas of research. And one of those is working with organizations that have particular problems. And so what I do is I come in and I meet with the people in the organization, figure out what exactly their problem is and what are the tools available in the community to meet those needs. And if there are 10 interventions, I just can't pick one random intervention. I have to pick the intervention that's best for the needs of this particular jurisdiction. So what needs to happen in Ames is a district-wide evaluation of what the needs are. And once we identify what the needs are, we can begin to pick an intervention that is best suited for the Ames Community School District. I would also say that it's so important to realize the interconnectedness among the schools here. This is not a middle school problem. We are seeing these in the middle school for a variety of reasons, but these are problems that exist in the elementary schools and problems that will be worse in the high schools. You cannot just focus on the middle school. And so if the Ames Community School District is serious about addressing this problem, the intervention must be integrated and concerted. And so we have to figure out how can we make a way from preschool through walking across that stage with your diploma to make sure that every child in the Ames Community School District is supported and achieving.
Well, you yourself have students in the elementary school, Monique Binkin, and you're African American. I'm assuming that your children are. How has their experience in your mind been perhaps non-optimal, or what do you have to say on that?
Well, so I have a variety of perspectives, right? So I am a researcher, but I'm also a parent.
Right.
And I am an African-American woman. I have two children who attend Sawyer, and we have had a fantastic learning experience. My children are extremely involved in the school, and I, as a parent, am extremely involved in the school process. So my children are, my daughter is learning at a grade level. She's performing extremely well. I think she was in the 90th percentile on the Iowa assessments last year. She's involved in orchestra. She was in the chorus. She's in quiz bowl. She is was selected by her peers to be a school ambassador. My son is in second grade, and he is an accelerated learner. And we had problems last year where the school couldn't keep up with him. So we had to work with the teacher and do some homeschooling on the weekends and the evenings to make sure that he was getting his needs met. And he's now working with the ELP teacher. So what I find is that my experience with the actual teachers in the school and Principal Lawler, who is fantastic, has been nothing but amazing. What I have found as I've investigated a run for the school board is that there seems to be a disconnect between what's actually going on in the schools and what's going on at the district. And so while I, as a parent, have been very pleased with the individual responses that I can get when I work directly with the school, I find that as a district, I feel like there hasn't necessarily been a concerted effort to address problems that we know exist.
Okay. Well, we might hear some of that in our next segment because we are going to report also on the Ames School Board meeting that occurred. The Iowa School
report cards were on the agenda of the school board meeting on January 30th. At that meeting, about 30 minutes was devoted to a discussion of the school report cards as Dr. Mandy Ross, Associate Superintendent, and Dan Andrews, Data and Assessment Coordinator for the district, talked through slides showing data from the report cards. One point that they stressed was that the data in the school report cards provides only a limited snapshot of what is going on in the schools. And there was a great deal of time devoted to talking about school attendance. In the slides and formal presentation by Dr. Ross and Mr. Andrews, the issue of the racial achievement gap was not mentioned. In fact, it was not addressed until Lewis Rosser, one of the school board members, asked about it after about 22 minutes of the 30 minutes spent on the school report cards overall. We're going to hear a segment of the audio from the school board meeting. First, we'll hear Dr. Ross and Mr. Andrews speaking, and it sounds like the school report card discussion is wrapping up until Lewis Rosser raises concerns about the racial disparity in achievement. At that point, Pam Stanglin, the middle school principal who we just heard, comes to the microphone to speak to that question.
One of the things we do look at is, can some of the Iowa School Report Card data inform some of our professional development needs, some of our program needs, and yet they're not really sensitive enough the way they're grouped, other than, for example, attendance, staff retention. Those data sets are a little more confined, and so they do give us some information about our program and professional development.
70% of these scores are based on Iowa assessments, and I'm concerned that that's the only proficiency measure in here. I would like to say if we're going to gauge proficiency, we're going to use something a little more broad that reflects what our teachers are teaching in the classroom and targets those things a little bit better. So proficiency needs to be in your conversation. Is this the right tool to measure that is the real question.
And I would propose the answer would be no. It's too broad. It's just not fine-tuned enough. I think we would both agree.
So I would kind of conclude from this presentation then that the Iowa School Report Card doesn't do much to drive our behavior. It's simply a reflection of what is, whether it's through assessments, staff retention, and attendance. And so it doesn't tell us much. We're just punching a ticket and giving the media something either good or bad to respond to. And so my gut tells me the less time we spend on this, probably the better, because there's more fruitful ways for us to impact the future than this. Is that fair?
I think it's extremely fair and accurate.
Any questions?
Yeah.
But I do
Mike,
have one
actually,
more
I do have a question for you guys. You know, one of the things when this data first came out, and I agree, you know, it's just the one assessment. It'd be great if it included more assessments and maybe a better assessment, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. But it is what it is, and it's the data that we've had for 3 years. So, you know, when I first looked at it, I was, you know, very proud of the leaders in our buildings, the teachers in our classrooms, and, hey, the students, because they're achieving. But there is a concern. And, you know, it's not just my concern. It's concerns that I've heard from people in the community regarding the middle school and the closing the achievement gap issues with our African-American students. Pretty dramatically, you know, 30-point difference in their proficiency from the average typical student at the school. And not only that, but it's actually in the past 3 years it's going in the wrong direction. You know, this year it's 53, last year it was 59, the year before that it was 61%. So going the wrong way. So I've heard what, and I think the first step, you know, with the attendance is the right thing, but what else are we doing to address that achievement gap? It's kind of what I'd like to hear.
And really, it's a lengthy list, and I'm so glad you asked that. I've been waiting.
Good.
This is not new data for us. This is something that is not new to our teachers, new to our administration. This is something that we've been looking at for longitudinally for multiple years.
As a matter of fact, that has been one of the areas of focus in our building goals. Although I'm not happy with going backwards. Everyone likes to be on top. I think we will be back on top here soon. But I'm really glad that we have the opportunity to shine the light on really the work that we're doing and the work that we know we can impact. I would much rather be in a community that has a diverse population and has this opportunity to make changes than some type of community that doesn't even have diversity and just, it's a good thing for us.
The other thing I would add to Pam's remarks are that we are actually starting a conversation later this week to be looking at, as part of our professional development, and that is really looking at cultural competence. Do our staff really understand how to meet the needs of a diverse group of students? Because, you know, if you've been in this community for very long, you know that this community has changed over the years. And so how do we make sure that we're responsive in our instruction relative to the diverse needs of our students? Because not all of them were raised the same way we were, and we need to respond to every single one of those kids.
And that was Dr. Mandy Ross, Associate Superintendent of Ames Community School Districts. That was at the January 30th school board meeting. I'm in the studio here on Local Talk with Dr. Monique Benkin. Dr. Benkin is running for the school board, and you are at that school board meeting. What were your thoughts as you listened to this again?
Well, I was at the meeting. If you watch the video, you can actually see me sitting behind Dr. Ross as she's making these comments. I'm wearing a green shirt. Not that you couldn't see me anyway, but, you know. And what you see is a double take. As soon as she said those comments towards the end about explaining this learning gap as cultural differences in the way Black children are raised, I was immediately surprised to hear such language. And it's a very slow, dramatic response to what she said. What I would say is that I had several thoughts about it. As a Black person, as a Black woman who was raised in the South, I'm from Texas originally, what I would say is that those comments weren't necessarily surprising. There is a perpetuating generations-long stereotype of the uninvolved, incompetent Black parent. And that's what's really being communicated here, that we have these learning gaps because these Black children are just not being parented well. And it's a stereotype. It's a harmful, divisive, unnecessary, hurtful stereotype that isn't the reality. It's untrue. I spoke earlier about my children. I know that there are other Black parents who do just as good a job educating their children. Education is important to our children. Education is important in the Black community. We understand the value of education. We want good things for our children. We want our children to succeed. As a Black person in 2017, there is some frustration that I have to convince the school board that I love my children and I want my children to be educated and I care about their education. But that's where we're at right now. What I would also say is I find those comments to really be uninformed, which is part of the reason that I'm running for the school board. I think that I have training, education, and expertise in this particular area. And what I would say is that Dr. Ross's comments seem to conflate a variety of issues. It seems to conflate the issues of race, socioeconomic status, and academic outcomes. Black is not the same thing as failing. Those are not synonyms. And we need a board that is aware that that's what's happening. Also, what I would say is that the attribution of cultural differences is inconsistent with the literature to explain these learning gaps. There are no studies that say the reason these gaps exist is because of the way Black children are raised. That's just not what the science says. And I would also say it doesn't seem to understand the reality of many families here in Ames. Not all Black children are raised in the same way. The Black identity is not monolithic. We all have different experiences. We all come from different places. And to just assume that, well, you identify with this group, you must have this background, is inaccurate. Another thing that I know to be the truth is that not every Black child lives with Black parents. So what this is part of what I'm saying. There is a disconnect between what's going on in the community and the schools and how the board is interpreting it. And I think we saw that in the exchange between one of the school board members and Principal Stanglin when there is a effort, it seems, to undermine or devalue the Iowa report card, even though she has already said these problems are real and we know that they exist and we're dealing with them.
Someone said the less time we spend on this, the better.
That wouldn't be the position that I hold.
Okay. Well, achievement on standardized tests is not the only area for which there are racial disparities in the schools in Ames. Another area is in disciplinary actions, such as in and out of school suspension rates. Tom Andre is someone in the community who has been looking into this issue for the past year or so. Tom Andre is a former faculty member in the Department of Psychology at ISU. He is also former chair of the Department of Curriculum and Instruction and associate dean for research in the College of Education. He's now an active member of a Mid-Iowa organizing strategy, also known as AMIS. And together with others in Ames, he has been working to call attention to racial disparities in disciplinary actions in Ames schools. We were interested in what his work could add to our understanding of racial disparities in the schools in Ames, so we sat down with him last week. He explained how he became aware of the school and district data that is publicly available from the Office of Civil Rights. All public schools in the country are required to report certain data to the Office of Civil Rights, so anyone can go to their website and look up information on any school. We'll pick up our interview with Tom Andre as he tells us what he found when he looked at disciplinary data from Ames schools over recent years. He also shares his thoughts on some of the reasons for this disparity and tells with whom he has shared his findings.
As I looked at the data, I realized that there fairly substantial, looking and consistent over from 2006 through the latest data set, which is 2013-2014. And they show differences running at least three times higher in school and out of school suspensions for African Americans as compared to whites. And somewhat higher, not quite as big a discrepancy for Hispanics. So I began to be concerned about that data and thought, well, I don't like that in Ames. I have heard from people in the community that African-American students have had bad experiences in the Ames schools. I think that, again, this data is consistent with that and that we need to say, how do we make every kid who goes to school have as good a situation as that person can have? There's different ways of perceiving the world. I think there's an issue that ways in which people behave might be perceived by mostly white teachers in a way that's different than African Americans perceive it. So I think that there is an implicit bias among teachers that relates to how they interact with African Americans. Just as a not recent example, but it's in the general news now, the fact that we never knew that there were a significant number of African American human computers involved in the development of space exploration. I think that's indicative of that we tend to perceive African Americans differently. And I think we've changed to some extent, but it's hard to get rid of those implicit biases that are both built into our culture and probably acquired as we develop in those cultures in ways that it affects your thinking in a way that you may not overtly recognize. I shared it with the Amos group. Talked to a former administrator from the Ames system, and then on his suggestion, we presented it to Tim Taylor and to the principal of the high school, Spence Evans. And we had a conversation about it, and I think that at the high school, they were attempting to do things to reduce suspensions and to use alternatives to suspension as a discipline technique. I guess I also thought that we needed to address the racial disparities more, or the ethnic disparities more. And then I also shared it with a couple of members of the school board, Tim Rasmussen and Louis Rosner.
And that was Tom Andre, an activist from the group Amos, describing how there are three times the number of suspensions, disciplinary actions for African-American students than for white students, and his efforts to draw attention to this issue. Dr. Monique Behnken, what can you add to Tom Andre's comments?
What I would add is that, again, we're lacking context. What he's really talking about is the school-to-prison pipeline. And we need to understand that's what we are facilitating in this particular district. We have to understand that there is a relationship between not having our children reading at an early age, and then we see that there are these disciplinary issues, and then we find that there are learning gaps, and then we start to see disparate school separation in the form of suspensions out of school, in school, doesn't really matter, truancy, that kind of stuff. We have to understand that all of these problems are related. And so you can't just target attendance. You can't just target the learning gap. You have to understand that what we're dealing with is a complex, systematic problem that requires systematic intervention.
Okay, and I think we're going to have to leave it at that, Dr. Monique Behnken. I would add, however, you did not mention Iowa's status as the state with the worst disparity in prison populations.
Yes, that has been a persistent problem that we see. This is kind of the end result of the problems that we're seeing here. All of these issues are connected, and if we don't address them as systematic, we won't really be able to affect the change because it's all related.
Okay, well, thank you, Monique. We look forward to hearing more about your campaign and your ideas as the season progresses.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Educated fleas, do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. In Spain, the best upper sets, do it. Lithuanians, and let's do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. The Dutch in old Amsterdam, do it. Not to mention the fish.
And we're back at our local talk at KHOI Community Radio. Wildlife correspondent Pat Schlarbaum came in the stations early this morning and reported that the Grays Lake eagle pair have mated and laid eggs. A little Valentine's Day reminder for all of you. We're here with Melissa Spencer, Deputy Emergency Management Coordinator. And
good morning.
Hello, and you're here to give us some other helpful reminders.
Yeah, we thought we would come in this month and talk about emergency preparedness, talk about preparing yourself and your family, and also talk a little bit about business preparedness.
Business preparedness. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, and really, you know, any preparedness activity really starts with understanding the risks in your community. Some of the top risks that we have here in Story County are winter weather, as people may go, well, that may not be something. We've had a pretty mild winter this year, so we've been very lucky. Severe weather, you know, heavy rains, winds, tornadoes, flooding, as we all know, about every couple of years we have our flooding events. And then hazardous materials events, that may be something that people don't think about, but we have a lot of train tracks that run through our communities, and also a major interstate that carries a lot of different commodities up and down it. Those are the top risks that we've identified here in Story County that people should be aware of when they're building their plans.
Okay, that's a wide variety of types of things that could happen to us. Are there some basics that we should always keep in mind that will cover most of the bases?
Most of the bases, what we generally ask people, we ask people to plan for 3 days. Usually it can take about 3 days for additional resources to come into a community, things like resources from Homeland Security, resources from FEMA. So a 3-day supply is what we always encourage people to build for their kits for at home. And that's a 3-day supply for each person. So we're looking at water is a gallon of water per day per person, which really does seem like a lot. But that covers consumption. It covers personal hygiene. Some of the other things that we talk about in the kit is flashlights and batteries, you know, the normal things you would think of if we're going to have a power outage. Non-perishable foods, you know, canned foods. And don't forget that can opener. That's something that's very important to have. You know, something that people really don't think about is copies of their important papers. So copies of insurance policies, copies of birth certificates, because if everything would be destroyed, you may have a hard time proving that, yes, I had insurance on my home, or yes, I had a driver's license, or, you know, here's my birth certificate. You know, a lot of those things that you need as you rebuild from a disaster are very important as well.
And sometimes I've heard when you go out to get supplies, for instance, a community's been affected by some kind of disaster or tragedy, then the people at those supply points are actually asking for an ID.
You'd be right, yeah. And even to get assistance with FEMA, lots of times you need to have an ID. So that's where those copies of those papers become really, really important for when you are going through that recovery process to show, yes, this is who I am. Yes, I was impacted by the disaster. So that's something that's very important to have copies of.
Okay. And what else do we need to think about? I guess our pets is always a big one.
Pets are something that people might not think about. Having a picture of your pet is also very important. If you become separated from your pet, reuniting and having a picture of your pet's important. Leashes, dog food, you know, just as we're having food for our families, we want to make sure we have supplies and food for our pets. And lots of times, too, after a disaster, the pets are not allowed to go into a shelter situation. The Red Cross currently does not allow animals that are not service animals into a sheltering situation. So having the documents such as copies of their vaccination records is very important for if the pet needs to be sheltered while your family is being sheltered as well.
Okay. And medications are an issue.
Medications are good to have. That one can sometimes be a bit tricky because sometimes insurance companies don't like to give multiple or long-term prescriptions. But we do encourage folks to try to have their medicines, an extra supply of those in their kit. That one sometimes can be a bit tricky. But really your personal preparedness and your family preparedness, the key to that is to involve the whole family. Get the kids involved. Have the kids talk about what things are important to them. And then the most important thing is practice it. Some people think, oh, we've got this plan. It's good. But unless you really try to practice it and practice, okay, where are we going to meet? How are we going to communicate? Thinking about during the daytime, we're all kind of scattered to the wind most days between school and work. If a disaster would hit while we're all separated, how are we going to communicate as a family and come back together? So it's important, just as important to practice it as it is to build the plan.
Okay. It sounds like it could actually be fun if you tried to make it fun.
You can make it really fun. There's a lot of great tools out there on the internet. FEMA has tools at FEMA.gov. ReadyIowa.gov has a lot of resources out there too, some templates, so it's not something that you have to create from scratch yourself, and it'll give you the talking points to develop your plan.
Okay. We don't have to indulge doomsday scenarios in bomb shelters and things like that. Well, you mentioned business preparedness. Talk a little bit more about business.
You actually can take a lot of the same tools that you're using for your family and apply that to business. Your personal preparedness for where you work, having a little go kit. One thing I learned that I never really thought about was most people, they're dressing business dress for work, and they have you know, dress shoes or high heels or something on. One thing I learned is keep a pair of tennis shoes or boots at your desk. So if you would have to evacuate, if there's been a disaster where there's debris or things, it's going to be kind of hard to walk around in those business shoes. So keep
unless you rip your hose.
True, or break a heel or something like that. But keeping a pair of tennis shoes, keeping a small go kit. You know, for businesses, have you thought about the impacts that your business will have beyond just the building itself? Your suppliers. Are there suppliers that are going to be trying to bring you things when you're in the middle of a disaster? Are there shipments that you're going to be sending out? And thinking about all those other businesses that are going to be impacted if you are down and cannot function. You know, and also thinking about how you're going to keep those your employees safe. How many businesses have a plan beyond, okay, this is what we're going to do with a tornado or if we have a fire? Have you thought about prolonged power outages? Have you thought about if your building becomes damaged to the point that you can't carry on business, how you're going to bring the business back, how you're going to continue to communicate with your employees during that time are things to think about with that plan.
I guess there's always sort of a more abstract type of safety would be cybersecurity.
Cyber is a very big, very hot topic right now with everything that's going on. You know, and unfortunately in the cyber world, we're kind of at a point where we are reacting to the damage that's already been done. But some of the things that we can do ahead of time is making sure that our computers are as up to date as possible. You know, having good policies in place, having good antivirus and firewall updates. Encouraging those employees to have those complex passwords and not using the same password for every site that they go to. Sometimes that can be difficult to try to remember all of those passwords. But those are definitely things that can help prevent that cyber intrusion into your systems.
How do you do that? I mean, I'm sorry. I just have to use the same password for a lot of different stuff because if I write it down, I lose the slip of paper. I just don't know what to do about that.
I actually talked with a cyber expert a couple years ago, and he actually said the best way to do it is to write it down, is to carry a notebook that has your passwords in it, because that's even actually now is to the point it's even safer than storing it on your computer somewhere, like in your contacts list. Some people I know do that. But it's actually carrying a notebook is the safest way to keep your passwords from being hacked, quite frankly, which is kind of funny looking at how technical we are now. But they said that's actually one of the best ways to protect your passwords.
Well, and then if you're part of some kind of drama where you suddenly disappear and people need your computer data, they can discover that notebook and unlock everything.
Yeah, yeah. You know, but it's just, you know, the cyber thing is just, it's such a fluid thing and it's changing every day. And there's new tricks and things that these people are learning. You know, but those few things are things that you can do that will at least give you a fighting chance to protect yourself and protect your business.
Okay. Well, I think that's all we have time for today in terms of disaster preparedness. Thank you, Melissa Spencer, of the Emergency Management Coordinator, Deputy Emergency Management Coordinator here, instead of Keith Morgan, who is off probably at a conference or something.
I'm not sure where he's at this morning. He just asked if I would step in this morning. So.
Okay. Well, it's nice to have you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. Our guest today was Monique Binken, a professor of sociology and criminal justice who is running for the board of the Ames Community School District. We also heard from Ames Middle School Principal Pam Stanglin and from various people at the Ames School Board meeting and Amos activist Tom Andre. Finally, Melissa Spencer was in from Story County Emergency Management. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoyfm.org. That's khoyfm.org. There you will also find information about our guests and links relevant to today's stories, like that Ready Iowa link that Melissa mentioned. Local Talk was engineered by Evan Taylor. Thank you so much, Evan. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Let's Do It by Ella Fitzgerald. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop, as well as a show. If you'd like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.